The suffragettes brought an army of women to the streets of Britain, the likes that had never been seen before or since. They burned down post boxes, they bombed buildings, they endured horrific prison sentences and barbaric force feeding, and some of them even lost their lives for their political beliefs. This was a woman's revolution, and at its head was Emmeline Pankhurst, a militant general leading her troops into a political battle. She changed the course of history, and for that, quite rightly, she's a global icon. But how much do we really know about this working mum from Manchester? I'm Sally Lindsay, and as we celebrate 100 years since women finally got the vote that they fought and they died for, I want to find out the true, gritty Mancunian story, the blood, sweat and tears behind this mythical figure. The loves, the losses, the political passions, the family tragedies that turn this woman into the leader of an army of women. This is the story of Emmeline Pankhurst, the making of a militant.
Emmeline Pankhurst, the making of a militant. A reconstruction.
The militancy of men through all the centuries has drenched the world with blood. And for these deeds of horror and destruction, they have been rewarded with monuments, with great songs and epics. The militancy of women has harmed no human life, save the lives of those who fought the battle of righteousness. Time alone will reveal what reward will be allotted to the women.
Those are Emmeline Pankhurst's own words, published in her 1914 autobiography, My Own Story, after one of her many hunger strikes in prison. But what is her story? Voted the woman of the 20th century, Emmeline Pankhurst is a famous face the world over. And like her, I'm a proud Mancunian, passionate about politics.
So I've come to the very heart of this suffragette city to find out more about the girl from Moss Side who grew up to lead a revolution.
I'm here to meet Emmeline's great-nephew, Michael Goulden, to see if he can shed any light on the start of her story.
She was born Emmeline Goulden, the eldest girl in a family of 11.
Wow.
And her parents, we know, were both politically active in a lot of the big causes that were taking place in Manchester at that time.
So this little girl was born into this?
Yeah, this is a picture of Emmeline, probably 13 or 14.
Wow, look at that.
She was clearly always the strongest personality in the family, and she was her father's favourite. He got her to read the newspaper to him every morning, so she was a precocious reader. She read from, I think, the age of three.
Wow.
And that was kind of another introduction, clearly, to politics and the news of the day. He recognised the strength of her character.
My father bent over me, shielding the candle flame with his big hand. I cannot know exactly what thought was in his mind as he gazed down at me, but I heard him say, somewhat sadly, what a pity she wasn't born a lad. My first heart impulse was to sit up in bed and protest that I didn't want to be a boy. It was made quite clear that men considered themselves superior to women.
Emmeline's father, Robert Goulden, worked his way up to run a cotton printing factory in Manchester. He and his wife, Sophia, were part of a thriving activist scene in Manchester, campaigning against slavery and for women's right to vote, also known as suffrage.
What kind of qualities do you think she picked up from her mum and dad?
She talks about, from the age of about five, actually going around collecting money at anti-slavery meetings with her mother, and also, I think, the experience of political organisation as well. I mean, her parents were active.
Emmeline was politically rebellious from a very early age. Although women were not allowed to vote, she sneaked into her first election aged just 10 to try and influence voters. It was an interest encouraged by her mum, Sophia, who was born on the Isle of Man, where they granted women the right to vote 37 years before mainland UK.
The likeness is quite stunning, isn't it, really?
This is Sophia Jane. She was going to suffrage meetings. She was subscribing to the Women's Suffrage Journal and taking Emmeline to the meetings.
Returning from school one day, I met my mother just setting out for the meeting and I begged her to let me go along. The speeches interested and excited me, especially the address of the great Miss Lydia Becker. I left the meeting a conscious and confirmed suffragist.
Emmeline was born and raised for the political battle, but her birthplace had a big influence too.
Even though Emmeline was an Edwardian campaigner, she grew up in a very Victorian world where women were rarely seen and certainly not heard. But here in Manchester, that was all about to change.
So women were very much second-class citizens in Britain at this point in time. They had lots of legal disadvantages, so when a woman got married, she had to surrender all her property and her earnings to her husband.
How would men look at women? Why don't they have the vote?
So women were seen as biologically different because they're seen as having smaller brains. We're seen as ill-prepared for the masculine world of work, politics.
So almost like cities. Children.
Almost like children, yes. So cities like Manchester were built for men. Just being a woman on your own on the streets, you risked being called a prostitute.
I'm absolutely gobsmacked by that. It's absolutely horrendous. Yeah. I can't see the women of Manchester putting up with that for long.
Absolutely. So Manchester really is key to the fight for women's suffrage. So we know that a real turning point for Emmeline was her experience of going to hear Lydia Becker.
Lydia Ernestine Becker was a talented botanist and has specimens surviving today in Manchester Museum. She would discuss discoveries of the day with Charles Darwin. Yet as a woman, she could never make this her career. Instead, she became a passionate campaigner for women's rights. Famous across the country, she was influential in Britain's first women's suffrage society.
She was a real heroine, but for a lot of men and certainly the press, she was heavily criticised really kind of caricatured, and they were really critical of the way she looked. So if we have a look at ways she was portrayed in the press, This is Lydia portrayed as a donkey, and she's being ridden by Jacob Bright, who was an important Manchester MP. And you can tell it's Lydia from the glasses. There's Jacob Bright with Lydia's head on a spike. It says, beware, female suffrage.
How do you think it influenced Emmeline's opinion?
I don't think we can imagine how difficult it would be to have been a woman in this era and take on a political role. But I think it would have also motivated Emmeline. She would have been angry.
Lydia Becker hit national headlines when in 1867 she marched a woman called Lily Maxwell to the polling booths to vote 50 years before British women won the right.
Nowadays, Lily Maxwell's landmark vote has largely been forgotten. I'm here at Manchester Central Library to find out more.
Well, Sally, here's a photograph of her.
Here she is.
Ferocious looking lady.
She looks rather stern, yeah.
So she was a widow.
Right.
And she had a small shop. Mm-hmm. The crucial thing about Lily is, because she was a widow, she was the householder. She paid her rent, and as a consequence of that, she found herself on the electoral register by accident.
How did that happen?
We really don't know, but what we do know is the actual evidence. And there she is. This is the Register of Voters.
Register of Voters?
For the Borough of Manchester, 1866 to 67.
Woman!
Woman.
An exclamation mark.
Absolutely. Nobody else is a woman.
How did she get in there?
Yeah. Here we've got Lily in the middle of the 19th century, 50 years before British women get the vote, actually registering her vote. There's her vote counted.
Wow.
It's in the newspapers of the day, and I imagine that Emmeline would be really inspired by Lily.
Lily's vote was hailed a victory, but it also turned out to be a setback. A famous court case followed where judges ruled the entitlement to vote did not extend to women. The women's cause was defended by a barrister who would go on to transform Emmeline Goulden's life, Dr. Richard Pankhurst.
So how old would Emmeline be at this point?
Well, so 1868, she's still very young. Dr. Pankhurst is already involved in the cause.
So Richard Pankhurst, to her, would have been almost like a bit of a local hero, a bit of a superstar, really.
So when she met him, it was quite an amazing thing. She said, "I was so charmed by him, he was so eloquent."
A radical lawyer campaigning on women's rights, Richard Pankhurst was famous across Manchester. If her family had lit a political spark in Emmeline, he was the one who turned it into a flame.
So he's 43, she's 21.
Gorgeous.
They met at a political meeting. They had quite a fast falling in love and quite a serious...
Huge meeting of minds.
Yes, absolutely. Every suffering cause shall be ours, he said to her.
Oh, that's fabulous, isn't it?
Married within months, the couple went on to have five children. Not only were they a love match made in heaven, but a political one too. While Richard stood for election as an MP, Emmeline became active in committees and causes, hosting political parties where she would dazzle guests with her singing.
Often I have heard the taunt that suffragists are women who have failed to find any normal outlet for their emotions. It is most certainly not true of me. My home life and relations have been as nearly ideal as possible in this imperfect world. Dr. Pankhurst did not desire that I should turn myself into a household machine. So while my children were still in their cradles, I was serving on the Women's Suffrage Society.
She's having children quite quickly. It's quite a successful marriage in every way. But she's also, if we look at this, attracting some public interest already. So here's a rare interview with Emmeline, long before the suffragettes, as we now know them.
So the question is, you do not find your work a bar to your domestic duties. In no way. I have four little children who, I might say, are quite as happy, quite as well looked after as any children. I think they appreciate me all the more because they don't seem too much. Wow, now that is progressive, isn't it?
Encouraged by Richard, Emmeline took a big step in her own political career. Standing as a candidate for the new Independent Labour Party, she got elected as a poor law guardian in one of Manchester's most impoverished areas, where she quickly got hands-on.
It's hard to imagine the ladylike Emmeline Pankhurst heading off to market and gathering up all the unwanted vegetables and boiling them all up into a hot broth. But in the harsh winter of 1894, that's exactly what she did. She stood on the back of a lorry in various soup kitchens here in Manchester, and she doled out her hot soup to the poor and the needy living on the breadline.
Her new role also brought her into contact with a local workhouse.
So you'd find a lot of women in the workhouse, women who'd been left by husbands or unmarried mothers.
So how do you think being involved with the workhouses affected Emmeline's approach to women and their suffrage?
Well, we can see that in her own words.
OK. So she says, I found that there were pregnant women in that workhouse doing the hardest kind of work almost until their babies came into the world. Then they had to make a choice of either staying in the workhouse, in which case they were separated from their babies, or they could leave. Leave with a two-week-old baby in their arms without anywhere to go. It's so upsetting, isn't it?
It was that experience that made her realise that women needed to have important influences at, you know, at the very top. It was men making all these decisions and women were suffering.
Now I began to think of the vote in women's hands not only as a right, but as a desperate necessity. These poor, unprotected mothers and their babies, I am sure, were potent factors in my education as a militant.
It was around this time that Emmeline took another step towards political activism.
In 1896, Emmeline hit the headlines with her first court appearance. Now, it'd be 7 years before she formed the suffragette movement, but in that moment, she realised the power of publicity in getting your voice heard, especially if that publicity involved even the slightest whiff of prison.
Well, there's a really interesting and often quite neglected and important event in Emmeline Pankhurst's history, and it's the Boggart Hole Clough incident in 1896.
Name.
It's a fantastic
it's
name.
A great name.
It's actually an area of parkland in Manchester. And it was used by the Independent Labour Party for political rallies. And in 1896, Emmeline Pankhurst, as well as her daughters Christabel and Sylvia, start giving a speech about the women's right to vote that's attended by 20,000 people.
20,000?
20,000. It's a huge audience for a woman speaker.
Yeah.
And shortly afterwards, she is summoned to trial. She's committed a crime against the bylaw of not holding a rally in this important park.
And how does she appear in court?
Well, there's a really interesting description of her wearing a little pink straw bonnet and very elegant black gloves. And she says, if the magistrate decided illegally, as she contended, to fine her, she would not pay on her own account, and she would be deeply indignant if anybody presumed to pay for her instead. Emmeline uses the courtroom, much like the one we're in now, yeah, as a theatre to actually communicate her cause and her politics to a wider public than she's previously been able to reach.
And I bet it caught the court system on the hop.
They're really concerned about the effect this might have.
She might go to prison.
Yes, precisely.
Together, Emmeline and Richard were a political force to be reckoned with, but a tragedy was on the horizon.
In 1898, I suffered an irreparable loss in the death of my husband.
Those matter-of-fact words in her autobiography hide the true heartache of Richard's death. Emmeline was on a trip abroad when things took a dramatic turn.
While she had been away, after nearly 2 decades of marriage, a clearly besotted Richard was still sending her love letters.
When you return, we will have a new honeymoon and reconsecrate each to the other in unity of heart. Be happy, love and love. Your husband, R.M. Pankhurst.
You can just hear how much Richard longs to see Emmeline again. But it was not to be. Despite a telegram asking her to rush home as his health was failing, Richard dies as Emmeline is on her way home. Legend has it that she read of his death in a fellow passenger's newspaper. And when she got off the train, she collapsed in grief.
Forced to leave their big house in a posh suburb of Manchester, she had to find rented accommodation and, for the first time, a paid job.
And she came here to this house in Nelson Street, which is now the Pankhurst Centre, which is half women's centre and half museum.
Tucked away next to Manchester Royal Infirmary, most people walk past this rather forgotten old building.
Now, what would life have been like for her here?
Well, she had to downsize to come here after her husband's sudden and unexpected death. He died of a perforated ulcer. And she describes it as being full of cheap American furniture. She came here with her family and they were completely grief-stricken.
So she had to get a paid job as a registrar. It was the first time ever she'd really had to...
Yes, this is her place of business, and she was a registrar.
So through that job, did she realise what was going on in Manchester? Did she realise...
Yeah, she saw the horrible working conditions of women and also the very heartbreaking stories.
So it says, I have had little girls of 13 come to my office to register the birth of their babies, illegitimate, of course. In many of these cases, they have found that the child's own father or some near male relative was responsible for her state, and there was nothing that could be done in most cases.
I needed only one more experience after this one to convince me that if civilization is to advance at all in the future, it must be through the help of women. Women freed of their political shackle. Women with the full power to work their will in society.
Now a working mum paying taxes, she was growing tired of words. The time had come for deeds. On the 10th of October 1903, encouraged by her daughters, Emmeline set up a new movement. I'm meeting her great-granddaughter, Helen Pankhurst, to find out more.
So we're sat in Emmeline's home, and this is where it all started. That's quite amazing.
Yeah, it has a wonderful feel to it, doesn't it?
It really does.
So this is the home where the suffragette movement started. It was called the WSPU, the Women's Social and Political Union. Mother and daughters, primarily, who just decided enough is enough. A new way of campaigning on women's issues was needed.
Why do you think it was decided here and now?
So it came on the back of more than 50 years of campaigning, more than 16,000 petitions, and a sense that nothing was changing.
So what was the final straw?
There was a fundraising in memory of Richard Pankhurst. In fact, actually, I think initially they wanted to raise money for the family because they were now,
of course,
a mother with all these children.
Children,
you know.
Yeah.
And then she said, no, let's use the money another way. They decided to build a hall in honour of Richard Pankhurst. And they asked Sylvia Pankhurst, my grandmother, to do the decorations. And then they decided that it would be a hall for just men. So, you know, after everything that they knew about what he stood for. So can you imagine a mother, a wife, who then has to face this indignity. Really.
You just feel anger, don't you? I feel, even now, in this room now, I can feel the anger that she would have felt of how dare you do that.
Outraged that the Independent Labour Party would not let women into their meetings at the hall, Emmeline was persuaded by her daughters towards more militant action.
You've got these strong girls that you're bringing up. One wants to become a barrister, the other wants to become an artist. And you see their opportunities thwarted.
So do you think this was a turning point for Emmeline as a character to become a leader, a figurehead almost?
All these different factors then mean that gradually, she becomes the leader that we associate her image and her name with.
As the leader of a new movement, Emmeline adopted a formidable public image to match and to inspire an army of women.
It's a military movement, it's a masculine, she's a general. I think she was also aware that the general of the movement would be ridiculed and would be labelled as it was, you know, with a punch and all the rest of it in really awful ways. So she consciously contrasted that public image with this very feminine leadership.
I suppose when you see the marches, that comes out as well, doesn't it?
They are marching as a band, they are marching like men, but they're in white, they've got the colour, I mean, the branding of the purple, white and green, the whole thing.
She was a master of PR, basically.
Over time, it would become an army. But it was in Manchester where the fight really began.
And it was here, at Manchester's Free Trade Hall, that that first real shot in that battle of the sexes was fired. When in 1905, Christabel Pankhurst and Annie Kenney insisted that the demand for women votes was heard.
This newspaper account of the court case that follows tells of the drama of their arrest. They put questions to certain of the speakers on a subject in which they were interested, and in order to emphasise them, one or both mounted the seats they had occupied and yelled and shrieked to the utmost of their ability. Miss Pankhurst spat in the face of the superintendent and also in the face of the inspector, and the latter officer she also struck.
You can just imagine the scene as those women were dragged kicking and screaming from this very spot. Now, they did this deliberately for maximum publicity, and it worked.
Both women were sentenced to prison. Seeing the national sensation it caused, Emmeline was persuaded that militant measures were the way forward. Their new tactics, more violent than the suffragists, earned them the derogatory nickname in the Daily Mail of the Suffragettes. But they adopted this with pride, and so began a campaign that would escalate from demonstrations to burning down properties and other violent protests, leading to more court cases, prison, police brutality, and horrific force feeding for the women, but also maximum exposure for their cause.
What good did it do? For one thing, our heckling campaign made women's suffrage a matter of news. It had never been that before. Now the newspapers were full of us.
And we've got some fantastic archive to show us just how big that movement was. We've got picture cards, and there's a signed one here of Emmeline herself. And this just shows how famous these ladies were. And this is the most amazing thing. This is the Holloway prison badge, which would be given to all those ladies that suffered horrific prison sentences that were given to them. And Emmeline Pankhurst was never seen without hers.
There is a perception of Emmeline and the suffragettes being too militant, and it went against the course, and it would have happened a lot quicker without them. And what are your thoughts on that?
You cannot talk about the suffragettes' actions without talking about the government responsibility for forcing them into a corner, for not giving them a voice, for treating them abominably. You've got a government with all the power that's stamping down them, quashing them, and they're being silenced. So they find more and more militant ways. Never do they hurt a person. They suffer. I think you take it, and there comes a point where you say, enough. And just from the comfort of our seats to say, oh, that was naughty, is just not good enough.
Their mission eventually took them to London and Parliament. But a banner recently unearthed shows Manchester never forgot.
Helen, tell us about this amazing banner, this exquisite piece of art hanging there.
So the banner was made in 1908 by the Manchester Women's Social and Political Union to be taken down to London on the biggest suffragette rally that had happened so far. And it has a very, very powerful message on it. It says, "First in the fight, Manchester, founded by Mrs. Pankhurst." And that was very, very deliberate. It was there to tell people that Manchester was the place where all this had begun. But it also stood alongside her on platforms, and it shows her dedication to the movement that she started here. What Manchester does today, the rest of the country will do 2 weeks later. That's what the suffrage campaigners always said. And really? I think that's exactly what Emmeline Pankhurst would have said as well.
People's History Museum curator Helen Antrobus.
Years of militant action, petitions and marches on Parliament followed. Ultimately, the vote for women was won. First for women over 30 with property in 1918, and then with equal voting rights to men in 1928 for all women over 21.
Sadly, Emmeline never lived to see this final victory in her life's battle. She died on the 14th of June, 1928, at the age of 69, her body frail and weak, after enduring 13 hunger strikes, weeks before the final bill in Parliament was passed. But even at her funeral, this article of the day shows that she was still very much the general of her army of women. The funeral cortege was awaited at the Fulham Road entrance to the Brompton Cemetery by a large number of suffragists. As the procession marched along, the people waiting either side fell in behind till it was an army that marched.
Although she had gone, already a legend was being born. Manchester has never had a monument to its famous daughter. Finally, she is being honoured in her home city with a statue by sculptor Hazel Reeves, who has brought along a scaled-down model to show me.
Wow!
Hi, Hazel.
Hi,
Sally.
She's magnificent.
Why she stood on a chair?
Well, this was a street meeting as they used to have. Somebody would grab a chair as like a makeshift rostrum, and up the 5 foot Emmeline would climb and address the crowds to rise up and demand their vote.
Wow, she's amazing. And what do you think Emmeline would think about her statue being in the middle of Manchester?
Well, I hope she'll be proud, but I guess if she was here now, she would be saying, "We've got a lot of work to do."
Oh, we have.
And she'd be grabbing a kitchen chair and urging sort of young girls and women to use their voice, keep fighting, keep marching.
Exactly.
The scaled-down model.
I think it's still hard today to understand how much courage and determination it takes to endure 13 hunger strikes in prison, to press on with your political beliefs in the face of ridicule and violence and arrest. But now, I think I know why Emmeline did it. Emmeline to me now is not just a global icon. She's a living, breathing human being, a charismatic, passionate woman, a devoted wife, a working mum. She didn't just believe in politics, she believed in people. And when she witnessed firsthand the atrocious treatment of women around her, she decided to do something about it. She decided to fight with deeds, not words, to make that change happen. She was born into the right family at the right time, but I believe she was also born into the right city. And I'm so proud that we are finally celebrating her here on her own turf, so her voice will be heard for generations to come.
They were awake at last. They were prepared to do something that women had never done before, fight for themselves. Women had always fought for men and for their children. Now they were ready to fight for their own human rights. Our militant movement was established.